Now, we return to Sicilia. We see Leontes after 16 years having passed. We then, and many of you commented on this, and it is one of the master strokes in the play, get the big scene that we were waiting for happen off stage. All of a sudden, we know daughter is going to be reunited with father. The two kings are going to be reunited. They're probably, except we don't see it. We don't see it. It is a dramatic masterstroke for two reasons. The first is the simple fact that he knew as a master dramatist, you cannot put two climaxes, two great dramatic scenes side by side. You're going to kill one of them, and the one you're going to kill is the second one. It will be a letdown. Therefore, the audience is expecting this, and they don't get it. Which makes the audience think, it can't end here, can it? This isn't the end, is it? It doesn't end in this way, does it? And the playwright comes back by saying, no, it doesn't. Watch what is beyond what you thought was the end. And we go into the chapel, and there is a statue there. Now, one weakness of the television production that can't be avoided because of the nature of the medium is that we lose stage illusion. It is very clear that what the author of the play wanted was the statue appears, and we in the audience are sitting some distance from it. And as we're sitting there, we can't quite tell if it's real or not. Wait, is it just a work of art? No, wait, she blinked. No, she didn't. No, that I blinked. Did she move? No, she didn't move. Wait, the audience should be staring at that statue, guessing. It's real. It's not real. Yes, it's real. No, it's not. With the TV version, the camera comes up, we know instantly. Some of the surprise is dissipated. The best production of this play I ever saw was in Minneapolis at the Guthrie Theater, 20 years ago. It was on a January night. It was 25 degrees below zero. There was heat in the theater, but I'm not sure where it was. The theater was packed because the production was a huge hit. I was lucky to get tickets. We were all sort of huddled in there. It was a winter's tale. It really was. The audience had been fascinated. It was a brilliant production. It moved along, and I could tell. I knew what was coming. The audience didn't. We come to the end of the next to the last scene. They're very puzzled, and then the statue appears, and it was marvelous because the director put her behind a slightly gauzy curtain. So it was a little bit hard to see as well. Could see the step. And you could feel them begin to lean forward. And as the scene became mystical, and it does, they began to suspect what was coming, and I have never heard such quiet in a theater. And all of a sudden the music began, and it happens to music. Every one of the reconciliations, renewals, at the end of the Shakespeare plays, happens to music. There's a study in that. I don't have time to go into it right now. Let's just say Shakespeare knew the power and mystery of music. Paulina says, music, awake her, strike, and the music begins. 'Tis time, descend, be stone no more, approach, strike all that look upon with marvel, come. I'll fill your grave up. Stir. Nay. Come away. Notice, it doesn't happen right away. There's an incantation. Bequeath to death your numbness, for from him dear life redeems you. And Hermione moves. There was a collective gasp in that theater. And everyone went about 6 feet up out of their chairs. The statue came to life, moved down, Paulina takes her, and
I can only describe it. I can only describe it as being exactly what Shakespeare wants in this scene, and that is, he is trying to get us as close as he could imagine to that heavenly vision of what that moment may be like when the dead come back to life, when all is forgiven, when redemption happens, when these mystical reunions take place, when that which was lost is found again, and when blessings descend on all alike. And it's breathtaking. For an instant, if you will, we get a glimpse of heaven. Dante gives it to us poetically in the Paradiso. Shakespeare attempts something tougher. He gives it to us dramatically with real actors on a stage. But we get a glimpse of it. And it works. And it's real. It's real. I have to tell this story. There is a danger in attempting too much at the end of a play. Shakespeare pulls it off. I think this is the greatest ending in all of theater. The following is a true story. This was a director who decided to doctor up an ending, to give it more punch, more power. It was a production of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Carousel being done at a summer theater in Illinois. I know friends who were there. There were eyewitnesses to this event. It ends with, it's a typical Rodgers and Hammerstein sentimental piece. It's not as bad as The Sound of Music, but it's verging on that moment. It ends with the full chorus singing, "You'll never walk alone." When you walk through a storm, keep your head held high and don't be afraid. Okay. At the end of the storm is a golden sky and the sweet silver song of a dove. Walk on through the wind, walk on through the rain, though your dreams be tossed and blown. Walk on with hope in your heart, and you'll never walk alone. You'll never walk alone. Just... It's completely overdone to begin with. Well, the director decided it just didn't have quite enough impact. He needed a little something just to give it that final punch. So he, after the final dress rehearsal, he talked to the property crew and said, "Here's my vision. Here's what we need. Go out and get me doves. Get me about a dozen doves. And we'll put them in nets above the stage. And then, just as the chorus hits that final note, we drop the net and the bird, the doves, fly out over the audience. And that'll do it. Oh, that'll really do it." So the prop crew goes out and gets the doves. And they get a net and they hook them up there. And the show goes on. And it's opening night and the place is crowded. And we come to the end and the chorus is, "Walk on, walk on." You know, and everybody's weeping already. Okay. "And you'll never walk alone." And the singer will release the doves. But what nobody had counted on is they have now spent 3 hours up next to the lighting instruments. We've got baked birds up there. They release the net and dead birds start dropping on the stage. Except for a handful that are half dead and flapping. And the audience suddenly stops crying, puts the Kleenex down, and is in horror as it watches destruction and death at the end of the show. That's my favorite theater story, by the way. But of course, what it suggests, what is there, the point being, you got to be very careful what you do at the end of a play. I mean, you can go too far. Shakespeare takes a gamble with this final scene. He takes a gamble, but it works. It is mystical on the stage. But he's again aware, and what he is insisting on is, This is reality. It is a reality we are not aware of. It's a reality we have not experienced yet. He touches her and says, oh, she's warm. If this be magic, let it be an art lawful as eating. Magic, art, eating. I don't need to underline that for you. There's again that vision of the nature of a sacrament that is indeed lawful, that indeed can what? Bring the dead back to life. Now, I have left out one whole level of this play. I'm going to go through this quickly because I promised I'd leave some time for questions, and I will. But let me pick up with this level by the comment that happens almost immediately after that. She embraces him. She hangs about his neck. If she pertain to life, let her speak too. Aye, and make it manifest where she has lived or how stolen from the dead. It's still not clear. Was she alive? Was she dead? What is? And Paulina says that she is living, were it but told you, should be hooted at like an old tale. We're back to the title of the play. The Winter's Tale. And Paulina is saying, look, if I tell you this story now, if I tell you what actually went on, you'd laugh at it. You'd laugh at it the way you laugh at old stories you've heard over and over and over and over again. You would dismiss it. But the whole point of the play is that the tale is precisely how we know what is true. On the highest level in the play, it comes, if you will, in the announcement of the oracle. We open it up, and the oracle, in a sense, tells a story. This is this, this is that, that's that, that's that, that's the way it is. We are told, and we believe by hearing. And what the play is emphasizing all the way through, from the title, from the beginning to its last moment, is you'd better listen to these stories. You'd better understand them, and there are some of them you better take very seriously. Why the emphasis on story? Let me put it this way. Our Lord is confronted with a question. Who is my neighbor? And responds not with a definition, but with, there was a certain man who went down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers. Over and over and over again, as our Lord spoke to us on earth to tell us what we needed to know, he spoke in stories repeatedly, which suggests to us, or should suggest to us, that if our Lord himself taught us what we need to know by stories, then he who created us must have put in us a desire to hear stories. It's the reason why the two-year-old, when it first can form a sentence, will say for the first sentence, tell me a story, Daddy. It is innate. At the moment we begin to acquire language, at the moment we begin to acquire reason of some sort, at the moment when we begin to sort out the world, what do we ask for? Tell me a story. I am making the claim that Shakespeare here at the end of his career is making a bold claim for narrative art. He is saying that, quite specifically, our very redemption depends on the story we've been told. And who told it to us? God himself. From in the beginning to amen is a story. And it is not accidental that for centuries now it's been known as the greatest story ever told. It's a narrative. I want to go back to the very first scene of the play and make the claim that he's giving us this information all the way through. The first scene is a very curious scene, and people have for a long while said, what's it doing here? Why does he begin it this way? Camillo is speaking with Archidamus, who never appears again, and they're just chatting. And what Shakespeare does is give us background information through these two men talking. They were trained together in their childhoods. They're rooted betwixt them such an affection which cannot choose but branch now. Since their more mature dignities, blah, 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 blah. They haven't seen each other in a while. They're here now. We have a young prince. Oh, yeah. Now, all of that could have been worked into the opening scene when Leontes and Polixenes appear. But instead, he's giving it to us in narrative form. I go back to that scene near the end of the play. There's a reason why we come to the big moment, and what do we get? We don't get it directly. We get it secondhand with some lords coming out and narrating what they saw. Here's what we saw. Here's what went on. Someone else comes on. And did you see when this happened? And what we are being demanded, what the demand being made of us is, you must listen and believe. And the reason we must listen and believe is because if we are told a story, it's coming from outside of us. When Leontes starts making up his own, he's in trouble. Faith comes by hearing. We have to hear the good news, and the good news is a story. And we have to hear it and believe it. The last thing that happens before Leontes storms in and makes his accusation against Hermione at the beginning of Act 2 is that Hermione has said, come, sir, now I implore you again. Pray you sit by us and tell us a tale, she says to Mamilius. The little boy is about to tell a tale to his mother. Merry or sad shall it be? As merry as you will, she says. And Mamilius replies, a sad tale's best for winter. The title of the play comes from Mamilius, the innocent one. As I called him, if you will, the light, the grace, in the beginning of the play. And he's going to tell us the story. A sad tale's best for winter. I have one of sprites and goblins. Oh, let's have that, good sir. Come on, sit down, come on. And do your best to fright me with your sprites. You're powerful at it. Mamilius begins. There was a man, his mother says, nay, come sit down. Then on, he goes and sits next to his mother. There was a man dwelt by a churchyard. I will tell it softly, yon cricket shall not hear it. This is for your ears, Mom, not for those other ladies. There was a man dwelt by a churchyard. Enter Leontes. Whoa! We know who the man is who's about to dwell by a churchyard for 16 years. Mamilius is about to tell the story of the play that we then see. And at the end, when we want to see something, we're told it. We are going between narrative and drama, back and forth. In the middle of the play, we jump over 16 years, and Shakespeare presents a chorus who comes out and says, okay, here's what I've done. I'm time. This has happened, this has happened, this has happened. I turn my glass upside down, and now it's 16 years later. So on with the play. And we're going, what, what, what? And for years, critics said, that's just foolishness, that's just foolishness. What's he doing? He's saying, I am the storyteller. I'm telling this story. This one's my story. I'm making it up. And in fact, if you want to follow this story, if you want to get to the happy ending, then you have to do what? Believe it. Go with it. It may seem absurd. We just had a tragedy. Now we're going to have a comedy. It was 16 years ago. Now we've jumped 16 years. Come with me. Come with me. Because if you don't come along and if you don't believe, if you're drawing back and saying, this story isn't important. I don't care about this story. I don't care to hear this story. You will miss the happy ending. What gives the playwright the right to do that? He's the creator of the story. The artist, like the man and woman in the bond of marriage, has been given the right to create in God's world. As out of the marriage bond, the act of love, comes new life, and God has sanctioned that, out of the imagination of the artist comes that which did not exist before, the Winter's Tale. But if we are going to participate in that creation, the Creator is saying, this is my world. I created it. I can do with it as I like. You must trust me now. Follow me to the end. There will be surprises along the way, but if you trust to me as storyteller, I will bring you to a place where all shall be well. It is the artist as a type of God himself. And what Shakespeare is asserting in every one of his last romances is there is a creator who oversees us, who has told us what we need to know, and we must trust in that creator to bring us to the happy end if we believe the story and play our role in it the way we have been told to participate. It's as simple as that. And if we don't, we're gone. And having worked through all of this, having followed it through, having come to the end, having Hermione restored, having mother and daughter brought back together, we are again left with an ambiguity, a wonderful ambiguity, where Hermione says, I will tell you tomorrow, for thou shalt hear that I, knowing by Paulina that the oracle gave hope thou wast in being, she says to her daughter, have preserved myself to see the issue. Self-preservation. How? Through grace, through truth, through loyalty, through perhaps death, and then returning. But it is in oneself self-preservation because she has played her part in the story and has come back as what? A work of art. A perfect work of art. That then has life in it again. Oh, she's warm, says Leontes as he touches the statue. The happy ending descends and then we get a last glimpse. And I do love this. I do love this. What? Look upon my brother, he says to Hermione. Look at Polixenes, both your pardons, that e'er I put between your holy looks my ill suspicions. This your son-in-law and son unto the king, whom heaven's directing, is troth plight to your daughter. It's all made up. Good Paulina, lead us from hence, where we may leisurely each one demand, and answer to his part performed in this wide gap of time since first we were dissevered. Hastily lead away. How will we spend our time should we be so lucky as to participate in that happy ending? What's the vision of what's beyond? Sharing our stories with each other. How did you get here? How did you make it here? How did you arrive at the happy ending? What was the road that led you to Rome? Tell me. And there are as many different stories as there are created souls in the world, all ready to share. And the glorious story that was the greatest story of earth, through God's grace, will turn into manifold stories in heaven that each will share with each in wonder and delight. Gazing all the time where? Heaven's directing on the beatific vision itself. How did you get here? How did we wind up here? Is it possible? Yes. Because it is a law, it is an art as lawful as eating. It's reality. It's more real than the here and now, where we are trapped in time, and time will turn his glass, and we will vanish, go into the ground, disappear. But if we keep faith, Paulina says, it is necessary you awake your faith. And once we do so, the reunion is possible, redemption is possible. For it is the plan of the Creator that we rise in glory. That's why he suffered and sacrificed. But it is up to us, finally, with our free will, to willingly subject ourselves to that plan of providence. To listen to the story, to hear the good news, and to believe it. Thank you very much. Be glad to take questions. Glad to take questions. Yeah?
Did Hermione really die?
It's a good one. It's a good one. Let me just say this. I can't answer it. I can't answer it because the play gives mixed signals. Okay? As I said last night, It is the only time in his entire work he withholds a piece of information. Why does he do it? He must do it because he wants us to believe she's dead. Okay? That's what he intends for us to think. Then at the last instant, no, she's alive. We have the sense she's been kept where? In this chapel. She's been kept in the chapel for this space of time. And then she says, I preserved myself. Yes, she's been living, but she hasn't been around. We haven't seen her. She's been in a chapel. No one, the body hasn't been seen. Who saw her? Pauline is the only one who saw her when she was gone. Then she comes back and says, I preserved myself. And now she's there. And she is living body and soul altogether. Did she die? We think so. The audience thinks so. But then she's not dead. And she was preserved. But it's that wonderful sense of how did it happen? Where was she? What was going on? He won't give us, you know. It is necessary you awake your faith. She's there. She's back. She's returned. Yeah.
She appeared to Camillus to Antigonus in the dream.
It's interesting. Antigonus says that she appeared in the dream, and yet, as he describes it, turn to that. It's in Act 3, Scene 3. Good Antigonus, since fate against thy better disposition hath made thy person for the thrower out of my poor babe, according to thine oath, places remote enough are in Bohemia, there weep and leave it crying. And for the babe is counted lost forever, Perdita, I prithee call it. For this ungentle business put on thee by my lord, thou ne'er shalt see thy wife Paulina more. That's all true. And so with shriek she melted into air. Affrighted much at it, dreams are toys, he dismisses it. I do believe Hermione hath suffered death. It's an odd dream. Again, it's an odd dream in many ways. And there are many places in Shakespeare, and I think he's doing it deliberately here, where we can't interpret what the dream is. Now, out of the dream, the child is named. The child is named. And she gives instruction to leave the baby there. And yet Antigonus is punished. And he just assumes that the mother's gone. Well, she's not. She will be back. So he's mistaken. The play has these mysteries in it. And he will not sort them out directly for us. What do we have to do? We have to just trust in the story. Because we don't know where it's going. We can't figure out where it's going. It's taking unexpected twists and turns along the way. Yeah. You know.
Anything else?
Yes.
Did they add a little bit to the end of that TV production? Giving away, I don't know if Camilla was really blessed by getting...
Again, that's a wonderful... I love that moment, actually. It's a wonderful moment. It certainly comes as a shock to him. But what it does, it does a couple of things. One, it reinforces the comic ending. We get a marriage and an unexpected marriage. What does it do? It also suggests this unity in a place where we did not expect to find unity. Okay, Camillo comes back and he gets it is a kind of reward, although admittedly it's a shock because this is a formidable lady that he gets. You know, but as I was saying earlier today. If someone says to you, you marry Paulina, you'd sort of gulp hard, but I think you'd go, okay. But you'd have to go ahead and do it because she is remarkable, you know? She is remarkable. And so I think he's in shock, but I think it's a good marriage. and again, what it is, the curious thing, in a way it's providential. In a way, again, it's providential. It's not anything that either of them suspects, but boom, there they are married. And it creates... every time I've seen the production, it's a wonderfully comic moment again. And what it does is it brings us back to a kind of reality. And there's something very sweet about it. It's healthy laughter. It's good, healthy laughter. And it'll be a fun... She'll cook for him. She'll do his laundry. I mean, it's just, she'll be a good wife to this man.
Yes.
Exactly. Yes. And again, what we have there, if you want to look at on that level, the two good counselors are now united. And we have the sense that everything is strengthened by that. Yes. It is a glorious, glorious sense of the strengthening. because they are the two who have spoken honestly all the way through, and now they have become one. It's a lovely moment in that way. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
What do you think, Leontes? Do you think what kind of legitimate reaction should he have had to Hermione's flirtatiousness with
Polixenes? It's very interesting, and this depends very much on the staging. I'm not sure we can call it flirtatiousness insofar as he gives her the order. He says to her, he won't listen to me, you convince him to stay. Okay? And all we know is that, and she says, I never exceeded the bounds. I never exceeded the bounds beyond that which a hostess owes to a guest. And as queen owed to my husband's best friend. If she says that, this is one of those moments where Shakespeare, if you will, includes staging directions in the text, which means if she is being flirtatious and playful in a way that sets him off, the director has violated the play, because she would not then stand up and lie and say, I never did anything, if she did. So we have to assume it is open, it does not go beyond the bounds. The only thing we know is that she takes him by the hand, and they talk at the side. And that's enough to set him off. But it shouldn't be anything more than just a gracious gesture. So I think it's contained in that way.
He was completely being unreasoned.
Totally. Reason disappears. Reason completely disappears, yes. The only question is, and this is the problem in terms of performance, does he come in already gone? Or is it something that happens at a particular moment? And that's difficult to determine. That's very difficult to determine.
You had mentioned that there are three portrayals of women that are
yes.
positive. I'm wondering, too, it just occurred to me that while I was pondering the role of Paulina, especially at the end there, where she is the one working the magic,
yes.
it seems, if that's possibly a type of Our Lady.
It certainly could be. I mean, it certainly could be. She is the one who has stood by and watched it all. She is the one who has seen the suffering, and she has suffered by watching the others. Entirely possible. Although what you'll find is, and this is interesting, almost any of the Christian archetypes you bring into this somehow light up. It is so rich with Christian symbology throughout. You can come up with any number of possibilities. Father Urtagoiti gave a wonderful one at table, the historical vision. Father, if you would just quickly from the beginning, the king and the queen. I mean, it's perfect. It's perfect.
Well, I guess that to me, the king was Henry VIII, was married to the daughter of the great emperor, and dismissed her against the decision of the pope. So he goes. He contravenes the decision of Rome, where these people have been seen sacrificed, and then there's a tragedy of England. But then again, the resurrection later on.
That's right. It's a wonderful, wonderful vision, and the reason I'm convinced it's working there, the preceding romance, which is called Cymbeline, is based on a king of England who refuses. To pay obedience to Rome. But it's the Rome of the Romans. It's a pre-Christian play. And he stands out against Rome, and there is a battle between Rome and England. And at the end of the play, the wicked queen, who has alienated him from Rome, dies. His daughter is restored to him. His sons come back to him. There's order in the realm. And then he decides, I will indeed now be obedient to Rome. He makes his peace with Rome, and they offer up sacrifice together. I mean, again, an audience watching that in 1610 would know, it's Rome, Rome, Rome all the way through, and the King of England finally submits to Rome. It's hard to miss what's going on there. And obviously, the pattern has to be in this play as well. Yes.
Someone could ask, and you wonder then, if all these signs are so obviously pro-Catholic, and in that sense, an anti-Anglican. How did he get away with it?
Simply because what he's done, and he can make the claim. I just did a play of Pandosto, is all. Everybody knows that. It's that old tale by Robert Greene, and I just put it on. What are you talking about? I mean, it's at such a remove, and it was popular in its way. And there is a way in which, I mean, it's interesting, and I will insist on this. It's not just a religious tract. It is a story. Okay? It is a play. It is a narrative. He's telling a wonderful story here that has all these overtones and I think this depth. That's not his primary purpose, and therefore he can say, oh, you're reading, he could have said, I can't imagine it was challenged. Oh, you're just reading too much into this. I mean, be fair. I just wrote a play. And in fact, you know, I gave it a happy ending. I wanted to be an entertainment. The crowd loved it. You know. We're packing them into the theater. Get off my case. He's built in an excuse for himself. Yes.
The last question: was Shakespeare couching his designs by use of pagan gods?
Oh yes, absolutely. Although it's interesting because Apollo has always been viewed as a type of Christ. That connection has always been made. So there again, he knows it's the oracle at Delphi, and it is Apollo that speaks, and that connection is there. But yes, of course he's couching it, and of course the references are to the gods. We have the Greek vision, but it seems very clear what he's up to, because this isn't a Greek. If this was Greek in nature, he would have kept the original ending: the queen's dead and the king commits suicide. And then it turns out that the young lovers are reunited and all, but it's sort of we don't feel all that good about things because there's blood all over the stage. In a way, that's more Greek. That's much more Greek. No, he puts, and again, what he's doing, he's putting the happy ending on it. Why is there a happy ending? Because I, as playwright, this is my play, and I will end it happily. Which is. It's interesting, too, symboling the play before. It's just... read it sometime. We come to the last scene of that play. There are 25 plot complications to be tied up. It is a multiple plot play. You follow it along, and it seems like the worst mess of writing anybody ever did. There are more complications. There's no way this thing can work out. And an audience has to sit there and say... oh man, this is just awful. And indeed, the ghosts rise up of the hero's parents and challenge the gods and say, why are you doing this to our son? And Jupiter comes down on an eagle and says, be quiet. What, you think I'm going to let you? I've got everything in hand. It's all under control. You better trust me. Just shut up. And then says, why have I made them go through this? Because those whom best I love, I cross. And then Jupiter goes back up on the eagle. We come to the last scene, and 25 plot complications. Happy ending. And you're sitting there going, whoa. It's the most extraordinary piece of dramaturgy because he ties every loose end up. They all fit together, happy ending. And you're left again feeling... how did that happen? And it's because he set everything up, knows where he's going, and manipulates it. But again, what you have the assertion of the playwright saying, I will have a happy ending. Now watch how I do it. It's all set up. But any one individual character has no idea what's going on. And they are it's a miraculous ending. They can't believe what's happening. Again, the lost are found, husband and wife reunited. You know, lost children come back. It's just it's very much the same thing, an assertion of a happy ending, because it is possible and it's the way the story must end. And it's fascinating. Yes.
How much is there? This just sort of comes to me. How much is there a connection, maybe even a criticism, with an early play, Midsummer Night's Dream? Because there's a king, a queen, couples, idyllic, and Puck seems to play a storyteller at the end.
Yes.
Is he sort of saying, like, when I did it before, I sort of mangled the way of doing it, but now I see that it can be done a different way?
Entirely possible. The reason that I would connect those two is, in my mind, A Midsummer Night's Dream is the earlier play about the imagination. And he just views it there as a delightful thing that can do good works, and, you know, it's a bit... here he gets into the dark side of it, but shows a depth of possibility that hadn't been there before. And the other thing, of course, is that Puck there is an imp who doesn't grow up. Here, the scan, Autolycus, it's a wonderful... Autolycus near the end saying, I've done some good in spite of myself. I didn't intend to help these people, but I've ended up doing it. You know, and it's a sense of even the rogues have to do good. They may not even will it, but if they're part of God's plan, they end up doing it and are surprised that they're doing it. Whereas Puck just remains impish to the end. I think you could... I don't know of anybody that's written extensively about that, but you could certainly make that connection. Yes, it makes sense to me. Makes perfect sense to me. Yeah. Anything else? Yeah.
In Act 1, when the Queen was talking about... you were saying something about original sin in the sense that when she mentioned not guilty.
That's right.
And then in Act 3, when she's being tried, she repeats that not guilty. Is there any...
That's, oh, absolutely. No, she isn't. She indeed is making the claim that the phrase appeared first time. It is, look, if you only, as I said, if you only tripped with us, if you grew up and your fall was to marry in the sacrament of marriage and then be true to your wives, then you're not really guilty. Okay, then that's all right. We'll handle that. Interestingly enough, when she's on trial, she stands and says, look, I will say I am not guilty, though no one will believe me. And there is again that sense that it is possible to live within the sacramental life. And you may indeed be touched with original sin, but you can still be pleasing to God. Okay? Original sin wiped away in baptism. You follow through the life, you follow God's commands, and you can stand, when the moment comes and the world puts you in the dock and accuses you, you can say, not guilty. Not guilty. I've done what I'm supposed to do. And I think there is indeed a connection there. And of course, it's interesting that the purest woman in the play is the one who gets put in the dock and the accusation is brought against. But again, she has the boldness to say, no, I will say I am not guilty. I love Hermione. I just think Hermione is just the most astonishing female character he ever created. Just the depth. I'm doing a seminar next semester, and it grew out of this notion. It's not easy to create a great villain, but it's easier to create a great villain than to create a good character who's interesting. It's long been a problem in art. How do you make the good interesting? And I think he does it in this play. I mean, Hermione is fascinating. Paulina is fascinating. These are good characters with depth. So I'm doing a seminar next called The Question of Virtue in Shakespeare's Romances, just looking at the last plays and talking about how Shakespeare creates the good. And I'm making them read Aristotle and Plato and St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas. And they're lining up trying to get in. They're fighting to try to get into this seminar. And the department's just furious. Just furious. You know? All those courses reading Hemingway and Virginia Woolf just thrown out the window. He's got them reading Aquinas. Oh, no! But they have depth. They have depth and personality. They really do. Yeah. Thank you again. It's been a great joy for me to be here, and I hope I am asked to return sometime.